We have a bunch of people on the line already and just waiting for some more before we get started. So, Glenn, this is being recorded as well?
Yes. Is that all right?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's good.
Is Jeff Newman on the call?
I'm here.
Jeff, Tony Harris, just one question. I wasn't able to make the call yesterday, but this preliminary report, version 4, which is sent on the 17th,
yep.
does that still stand as our basic document, or has it been changed a lot?
There were some changes we made yesterday. I'm probably going to send out the next version by tomorrow.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jeff, this is Steve Metallus. Is there an agenda for this call?
Not an official agenda, but basically the format of this call is really just for information sharing purposes. So what we're going to do is go through each of the three task force chairs. And we have Brian. Brian, you're on?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. Each of the three task force chairs are going to just talk a little bit about the status of their findings. The role of their task force, and then ultimately in the end we just want to really engage in some information sharing, make sure that we're not overlapping on each other's reports, and the purpose of the call is not really to debate anything that the other task forces may have found, any of their findings. We do anticipate after the preliminary reports having joint sessions with several of the task forces. Probably all three of the task forces, but certainly one and two are very closely related, to try to straighten out any areas where there may be some overlap and to try to combine those task forces into one, so that we can come out with a pretty concrete final report. So really, it's a pretty loose agenda. Again, the three task force chairs just going to go into some of the findings and maybe... If anybody from those task forces want to add anything to what the task force chair is saying. And then at the end, we'll try to organize and coordinate so that we could set up meetings after the preliminary reports come out. And I believe the date for all the three preliminary reports is the end of next week. So we're kind of getting down to the wire. Jordan, Brian, anything you guys want to add?
No.
No, I agree with that agenda. I think that makes sense.
Okay, so why don't I have Glenn do a roll call of everyone that's on, make sure we've got someone from each of the constituencies here. So, Glenn, if you could do that.
Yes, I'll do a roll call. Is Amadeo on? Tony Harris?
Yes, I'm here.
Ron Dalvo?
Glenn.
David Ferris?
I'm here.
David Maher. Fanny Willings. Greg Ruth. Jeff Newman.
Here.
Jeremy Banks. He sent his apologies. He will not be able to be on the call, but normally John Wolfe should be joining. Is John on the call? Jordan Buchanan.
I'm here.
Kathy Kleinman. Ken Stubbs. Kiyoshi Tsuru. Maggie. Marilyn Kay.
I'm here.
Maggie, you there. Good. Marilyn Kay. Marilyn may have problems getting on because she is out of America.
David Maher joining.
Thank you, David. Newton Miller. Nicholas is on.
Yeah, I'm here.
Paul Stahura.
Paul Stahura is here.
Ross Rader.
Yes, I'm here.
Sarah Deutsch. Steve Metallis.
Here.
Kerry Clark. Tom Keller, Thomas Schussler? Thomas was on earlier. He might be on mute. Barbara and Suzanne Sin. So we have got...
Yes, here.
Thank you. We have got ISP, IP, business, Kathy's not on the call, is she?
I just joined, Kathy.
Okay, good. Then we've got non-commercial. We've got all the constituencies represented, but not necessarily all the task force members.
Okay, and then you do think, is Thomas the only one from the ALAC?
Thomas is the, he was right at the beginning on the call, so I think he's probably on mute.
Okay.
Are there any of the task forces that are, like, completely underrepresented, like they only have one person here? Or is there a good mix?
I think there's quite a good mix.
Okay, good.
The non-commercials have only one person on. Kathy?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think that's good. We can get started. If the people who aren't talking, if could put their phones on mute because we have this echo. And you do that by pressing 6?
Yes.
So I'll give a second for everyone so we can hear all the beeps. Okay. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm Jeff Newman. I'm the chair of Who Is Task Force 1. And we also have Jordan Buchanan, who is the chair of Task Force 2, and Brian Darville, who is the chair of Task Force 3. So we're going to spend a couple minutes, each of us, going through what our task force's role is and what our findings so far have been and kind of what our preliminary reports are going to look like. And then I'll ask, after each chair goes, I'll ask anyone from my task force if they want to add anything. And Jordan will do the same, and then Brian. And then ultimately our goal is to talk about how we can coordinate our efforts afterwards, after the preliminary reports come out next week. I think it's a little bit too late at this point to probably affect the preliminary reports, except to the extent that these reports may kind of overlap, and we can kind of work that out. Who is Task Force 1? Our role was really to talk about access to Who Is information, talking specifically about Port 43 access and web-based access. I don't know how many of you recall, but last year the GNSO Council, for a few years the GNSO Council and the task force have been working on Who Is, and one of the resolutions last year in 2003 was that to reaffirm the notion that Who Is data in bulk for bulk access shouldn't be used for marketing purposes. But it never addressed how to handle data mining with respect to Port 43 access or web-based access of Who Is information. And going back to, this is not really a new issue. In fact, one of the things the preliminary report goes into that we have so far drafted is back in 1999, with Vireo and Register.com, there was a lawsuit filed back, I think it was either 99 or 2000, it was in 2000 where Register.com filed a lawsuit against Vireo for basically what Vireo did was to go to the registry, download the zone file, and then compare the zone file from day to day and do a lookup using port 43 of each of the names that were different from the two zone files. So each of the ads, for example, they would do a lookup, and then they would send out marketing solicitations to all of the new registrants trying to get them to purchase web hosting. And so that was kind of the first real instance where people started to get the notion of data mining of Who Is information for marketing purposes. And it was very blatant, and there was a lawsuit filed, and ultimately an injunction issued against Vireo from doing that kind of activity. Since then, obviously more institutions, not just registrars, but a lot of entities have been engaging in data mining by doing the exact same thing, downloading the zone file and then mining port 43, or have come up with other mechanisms of just mining the data. So our role, our task force, was assigned the task of trying to figure out how the contracts could be changed. And
you are now muted.
Commit the data mining for marketing purposes. And so specifically our milestones were to develop a needs and justifications. You know, first, before we can apply access restrictions, we need to look at why people actually access WHOIS information. The second thing was to review the approaches that were out there currently to prevent data mining. And the third is to require any changes that would be needed to implement new policy approaches to prevent data mining. So without going into any detail, there's obviously a lot of information out there. And we did another survey as to why people use or how people use WHOIS information. No question that, you know, even if WHOIS was originally for purely, quote, technical purposes, and, you know, even that's debatable, but even if that was the original intention, certainly WHOIS information is used by a number of different groups or has become used by a number of different groups. And so we've kind of, without getting into that debate as to what the original purpose was, we've kind of just said this is what the original purpose may have been, but despite that, this is what it's being used for now. And so we lay out the needs and justifications for WHOIS information. The general approaches that have been used up to date have been things such as providing graphics on websites that you would have to, you know, if you're doing individual queries, you would go in and you'd have to retype whatever the graphic is showing, whether it's a word or just a mixed number of characters. You'd have to type that in order to get results. We found that that has some mixed results. Although it's not perfect and there are ways around it, some registrars truly believe that it has become a valuable obstacle for them in preventing data mining with respect to the web-based version of WHOIS. And other mechanisms, obviously that can't apply to port 43. So what people have done is rate limiting and trying to kind of block, not necessarily block IP addresses completely, but certainly limit the number of queries that those IP addresses could do. And then if they found abuses, then they would restrict those IP or queries coming from that IP address. And again, that's not the perfect mechanism because it's pretty easy in this day and age to get new IP addresses and just keep going from, you know, rotating IP addresses. So, you know, we found that neither of these two solve the problem. So in order to come up with new policies, we pretty much tried to start with some general principles. And the general principles we've come up with are that, you know, obviously the work that we're doing with Task Force 1 is highly dependent on the work that's going on in Task Force 2. We found that, and this may seem obvious, but the more sensitive the data is, that the more value there is to the data from marketers and other entities, and the more likely such data is to be mined, and the more this could impact the privacy rights of individuals, and the more this creates an incentive for the registrar to make his or her data inaccurate. Again, that may seem kind of obvious, but it's kind of an important step and set the basis of everything else we did. Although our task force did engage in a number of conversations about what data we thought was sensitive and non-sensitive, in order to help us, we were not really able to necessarily come to a consensus on what we thought was sensitive versus non-sensitive, except for a few elements that we'll put in our report as to what we thought would be not sensitive. And really the ramification of why we did this is, again, if something is not, if the only data that were to be revealed, if WHOIS Task Force 2 decides that only non-sensitive data is to be publicly disclosed, then obviously we wouldn't have the same access concerns that we would if sensitive data were to be disclosed. If Task Force 2 decides what we thought was sensitive data should be publicly disclosed, then we talked about, our recommendation is that at a minimum, the person who comes in to request the WHOIS information, and we'll call them the requester, should identify themselves to the WHOIS provider, whether that's the registry or registrar or other entity, and the requester should then also indicate the purpose for which it seeks the data. and then that information will be provided to the registrant, except if it falls under a limited exception for certain law enforcement investigations, whether that be criminal or civil, who may need the information without having to provide the registrant the information as to why it's seeking the information. Again, there's a lot of details that would need to be worked out, a lot of questions, and we're going to throw that out in the preliminary report, try to get some feedback on it. You know, how broad is that exception? How would we enforce that exception? What entities would be considered eligible for that exception? A whole host of questions on that subject. And we fully anticipate, you know, that generating a bunch of feedback. Again, if this kind of measure was employed, we believe that there should be some sort of authenticating mechanism. So, in other words, we would actually authenticate that the requester is who they say they are, whether that's through certificates or some sort of other mechanism that needs to be worked out as well in some sort of implementation. The question of what happens to Port 43, again, all of this is premised on the fact that sensitive data will be disclosed. Again, if Task Force 2 decides no sensitive information will ever be publicly disclosed, then this, none of this would really apply. But to the extent that sensitive data is going to be released to the public or to some segment of the public, then we would advocate this. What to do with Port 43? Port 43 can't handle, the way it's designed, can't handle this type of functionality. So our recommendation is that Port 43, to the extent that it can't handle this functionality, would be pretty much eliminated except for use by registrars for transfer purposes. Again, this is not full agreement with the entire group, but it's, we're kind of leaning towards that approach, simply because Port 43 doesn't provide the functionality. Now, then the next step is, well, if you don't have Port 43, is there some other mechanism that you could provide that would give some sort of automated access, ones where you could do searching? And the group, this is the most contentious issue. The group pretty much, what we have now is that some members of the task force stated that they may not be fundamentally opposed to having some sort of automated mechanism to retrieve sensitive data for approved requesters with approved purposes, provided that the requester is asked to sign a license agreement stating that they'll use the data only for the purposes indicated, that the data will not be used for marketing purposes, that the requester will be prohibited from leasing, sublicensing, reselling, or otherwise transferring the data to any third party, that the requester identifies themselves to the WHOIS provider, and again, like in the other instance, that the requester's identity and purposes for such information is disclosed to the registrant with that limited law enforcement investigations exception. One thing I wanted to clear up is that, you know, there is a restriction on leasing, sublicensing, reselling, or otherwise transferring the data. In order to allow groups like Thompson & Thompson, the group discussed somehow trying to figure out a way that they could do this by acting as an agent of the actual requester. And if they act as an agent, then they would have to list the actual requester, you know, the entity that hires them to get the information. Again, so, you know, assuming there could be this approval process, you know, how do you approve requesters and what that process would be, we envision would be the creation of something like a whitelist. Who would manage this whitelist, how they would approve these entities, is kind of all up in the air at this point and things that we're seeking feedback on. Obviously, that would be a substantial amount of work by an entity, whether it's ICANN or some other registry entity. I use registry not in the top-level domain sense, but in the generic sense of a registry to maintain this list of approved requesters. So there's a number of concerns that people in the constituencies have obviously stated about this type of approach, and that will be reflected in the report. Ultimately, we're seeking some comments. We have a number of different questions that we'll put out there for everyone to answer or to provide feedback on. And finally, we basically say that our final thoughts are that, you know, we need to pay attention to the work of the IETF or by the CRISP working group on the IRIS protocol, because that would provide some sort of mechanism for this tiered access approach. And obviously a cost-benefit analysis would have to be done, not just for registries and registrars that provide the service, but for all end users as well. And then obviously a feasibility study would have to be done on all of this. So I think that's basically what our report, I probably went a little bit too long, but that's basically what our report is going to say. Is there anybody from Task Force 1 that wants to add anything to that? And I know from Task Force 1 we have Paul Sahara, Tony Harris, David Ferris, David Maher. Does anybody want to add anything?
And Wendy Seltzer joined.
Oh, hi, Wendy.
And John Paul joined.
Oh, hi, John. Does anybody want to add anything to the summary I've given?
I just wanted to add, we did talk also regarding the whitelist about, you know, storing the data in a database and whether the entities on the whitelist, whether it was kind of an all-you-can-eat thing where they could just download all the data or, you know,
right.
Whether they have to do one query at a time kind of thing.
Okay, well,
right.
What I've got is,
So that's one of the questions that we posed out for public comment is, you know, if it's a whitelist, as Paul was saying, if a requester is approved, does that mean they're approved for all purposes to do any amount of searching, or is it on a case-by-case basis? And we haven't formed an opinion on that at all. We're just kind of throwing that out. Anybody else? Okay. Is any other, I'm sorry, Wendy, is that you?
Yeah, I don't know if I missed something at the end on the port 43, but I thought that there had been at least a minority consensus that port 43 should be left as is, unregulated except for registrars rate limiting, but limited to non-sensitive data.
Yeah, I think what I discussed is probably the majority view on each of these, and with all of these, there's going to be obviously other opinions, and those will be reflected in the report as well. Is there anything,
I think it was a very good report, Tony Harris. Here.
Is there any, thanks. Is there any questions from any other task force members on the work that we're doing?
Jeff, this is Steve Metallis. I had one question.
Sure.
You referred a lot to sensitive data, non-sensitive data, but I think you said at the beginning of your presentation that there was not agreement on what is sensitive data and what is not sensitive data, or did I miss something about that?
No, I think we did spend a number of calls talking about what would be sensitive and not sensitive to kind of set the basis. The ultimate conclusion is that that's probably something that's more in Task Force 2's purview, but something that we would like to talk with Task Force 2 after the preliminary reports come out, because we have our own ideas, because it's not necessarily the same thing to say, you know, Task Force 2's role, and I may be wrong, but our view was that Task Force 2 is deciding what's publicly disclosed and what's not, and in our view, some of that may be sensitive, some of that may be non-sensitive, but to answer your question, Steve, we did agree on a number of things that we thought were not sensitive. But with most of the other items, we were not necessarily in agreement. There may be a majority view, but certainly not consensus on what should be classified as sensitive or not sensitive at this point.
Jeff, it's Marilyn. Can I ask a question as well?
Sure.
It sounds like that a fair amount of the procedures and the processes related to the whitelist is yet to be developed. Is that right?
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, all right. And including, did you have discussions about the cost of developing the whitelist or maintaining it, authenticating it, those things, or is that yet to be done?
That's yet to be done and one of the things that we're seeking feedback on.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is really... we're looking at this preliminary report as an opportunity to throw things out there as to subjects we've been talking about.
Sure.
But ultimately, in the end, you know, one of our biggest things is that, and I don't know if you missed this, but certainly a cost-benefit analysis needs to be done, a feasibility study needs to be done. All that work needs to be done before any of this could be put into reality. or even any of this finalized as a concrete recommendation to the board. So, again, it's still in the preliminary stages, but that being said, I think Task Force 1 has come a very long way from where we were at the beginning, and we've all pretty much drilled down on these ideas, and assuming some of these things can be worked out, you know, I think we've come up with some pretty good ideas.
This is Kathy. I have a question.
Sure.
Kathy Kleinman. Jeff, you mentioned that when sensitive data is accessed, that Task Force 1 had a recommendation that the registrant be notified.
Yes.
And I wanted to know if you guys had talked about method of notification, timing, any additional details, because we've been talking about that in Task Force 2 as well.
What we've talked about is the only discussions we've had in detail on that is that the registrar representative, Paul, has advocated that he would recommend that be done by the registrar, you know, because they're a customer, and so they would have a preference that it would be done by the registrar. Other than that, as far as timing or anything, those are implementation details that we did not get into at this point. But certainly good questions that would need to be addressed probably between now and the final report.
It's Paul Stavola. I just want to add, I think we also talked about if it wasn't the registrar, if it was the registry making the notification, then they would have to do it via email. Since there's no, you know, account or whatever for the registrants to log in at the registry. And therefore, if there was a lot of queries, the registrants would be receiving a lot of email notifications saying, you know, who looked up their who is information. And that was one issue. And then I believe the registries, David Maher, I'm recalling that he agreed that would be a problem. And that also, I was envisioning, you know, the burden would fall on the registrars to do this, that maybe, you know, regarding the timing, maybe they would collect all the information, all the, you know, who was request information, who requested it, when they requested it, and so on, and display that not asynchronously to the user. In other words, they wouldn't message the user like then the user would log into their account or whatever the registrar provided, and you have like a report listing who looked up the who is and when.
Right. So just to sum up, because Paul, I think you were a little, because I guess your connection, just to sum it up, there are different, you know, the belief now is, you know, that at least in Task Force 1, is that it would be done by the registrars for a number of different reasons. And it doesn't necessarily have to be by email. It could be on the registrar's website, you know, in the registrar's account. They can log in and see what's going on and who's looked up their data.
Thank you.
All right. So in the interest of time, I want to kind of move it on to Jordan.
Thanks, Jeff. I'll try to keep our summary fairly brief. But basically, Task Force 2... our terms of reference cover a variety of things, but basically we are chartered to look at the how data is collected, not necessarily how the actual mechanism, but how registrants are notified about data as it's collected, what data is collected, as well as under what circumstances it is displayed, I guess, would be my brief attempt to summarize the terms of reference, which are obviously available online. But we've spent a good amount of our time, as I know the other task forces did as well, looking at, you know, doing data collection and so on, and a reasonably large chunk of the initial report is probably going to be the results of the data collection process. But I'll just talk briefly to the actual sort of findings that we've been making. And we've divided our findings into essentially five areas, which are notification and consent, proxy registrations, local law, collection of data, and display of data. So the first of those, notification and consent, one of our milestones and one of the provisions of our charter is to look at how registrants are notified, how data is being used, or what data is being collected, and what the purpose is. And we found that there's not really a particularly consistent answer to that, and the general feeling of the task force is that it's probably fairly important for the registrant to be well informed about what the data is being collected for, and in particular that some portions of it will be displayed to the public. So to that end, we've actually agreed upon I think we're finalizing language right now, but the general idea of a recommendation that registrars be encouraged to provide more explicit notification that the data is going to be published, and perhaps even that registrars ought to have a separate agreement, not necessarily a separate legal agreement, but a separate checkbox or something like that, where registrars, where registrants can indicate that they do consent to these provisions. The second area relates to proxy registrations, which a number of people suggested might be a suitable way of providing some added degree of privacy for registrants. We've spent some time in our data collection phase looking at the proxy registration services that exist, but we still ended up with a large number of questions and weren't really prepared to make any substantive policy recommendations, I think. So our recommendation instead is that we think that there is a large amount of additional research that needs to be conducted into these services to see whether or not they achieve both privacy and contactability objectives, along with circumstances such as when data is released, when data is unmasked, essentially. Let's take a look. The third general area is local law. And one thing that we found is that there are a number of countries and localities and various other places that do have laws that may be related to that relate to privacy and may be related to the who is in particular. So one of our tests has been to see that there may be circumstances in which those laws come into conflict with the requirements of existing ICANN contracts. And the one example that was identified where this seemed to sort of play out was .name and their revised sort of approach to who is, which we don't believe has actually been implemented yet, but basically has implemented some sort of tiered access system, essentially, to who is data at the behest of the UK data commissioner. And it may be in the future other circumstances like that will arise. And so one of our recommendations is that registrars and registries, essentially, if they are confronted with a situation where there is a privacy regulation that conflicts with their who is obligations under their ICANN contract, that a consultative procedure be in place by which they can work out a process to comply with the local laws and regulations. And indeed, if there is an urgent need to change the information display, that they can do that on fairly short notice just by providing written notice to ICANN. The next area that we looked at was the collection of data and what data fields were gathered. A few constituencies had suggested that there be significantly less data gathered by registrars as a requirement, that they could continue to gather it, but it not be required by their ICANN contract. Similarly, a few constituency suggested that there was some additional data that might be gathered. Ultimately, this is not an area where there was significant consensus on either side, and as a result, we did not have any policy recommendations in this area. And so the last area relates to the display of data, and this, I think, is where we get into some significant overlap with the work that Task Force 1 is doing, because obviously Task Force 1 is looking at mechanisms and, you know, differentiated access to different data elements and so on. And I think that we have, at a high level, are in the process of endorsing a similar approach that probably still needs to be reconciled. And I think, as Task Force 1 has indicated, there's a fair amount of additional inquiry to be done in this regard. But basically, we've suggested that we think that some sort of differentiated access may be an effective way to balance the needs of privacy and contactability, that further that it seems that technical and sort of very basic information about the registrant and the administrative contact should be available, like their name and what country they're in, to the public, but that additional data, particularly contact data like, you know, home address or you know, mailing address or telephone number or email address, probably should belong in a protected tier. We also, I think, are ready to endorse the idea that there should be, if such a system were adopted, there's certain protections that should be in place to make sure that there's still a way to get timely access to that data, to make sure that the system is affordable. And there's a number of questions we raised about, you know, how people would be identified and what, specifically what data would be, you know, revealed even to even in a protected tier, and whether or not it should continue to be all of the information, or whether some information maybe is in a further tier that is not available through the sort of usual, whatever the usual protective mechanism is. So I think there's not a lot of contradiction there with Task Force 1. I think there will be quite a bit of work after the publication of the report to sort of to line up the details and to make sure that, you know, all of the assumptions do in fact mesh, but the general approach seems to be fairly similar. And I would probably conclude my comments there. That's sort of the high level of where we are, I think. And I at this point probably invite anyone else from Task Force 2 who thinks I'm missing something to feel free to comment at this point.
George, this is Marilyn. I have a question of that may be clarification for you.
Sure.
You said that, and I that you think the task force is ready to endorse some form of differentiated access. I'm not. I think at least for my constituency, we were ready to endorse examining some form of differentiated access. I think that's a little different than endorsing some form of differentiated access.
Right. I think that, you know, we will, that distinction is likely something that will be hammered out over the next week. And I think you're right that it's probably, you know, we probably don't have unanimity on the idea of saying that we should implement such a system. But I think there is close to unanimity that further examination is appropriate at the very least.
Yeah, okay.
Jordan, this is Jeff. Just a question. When you talk about differentiated access, how is that different? How is the work that you're doing different than the work that Task Force 1 is doing when they're talking about access? Just to clear that up, and then, or is it probably something that we'll really need to coordinate on afterwards?
Yeah, I think there's significant overlap there. I think we have been, every time for a variety of reasons, including, as Marilyn indicated, that some constituencies are much more comfortable with the idea of sort of further examination as opposed to, you know, actual policy recommendation to implement something like this, that I think the language you'll see on the recommendations is pretty vague. But, you know, basically one of the questions that we've been posed is whether registrants should be able to sort of opt to display less of their data or something along those lines. And so one of the – we looked at differentiated access as being perhaps a mechanism to provide that capability. And I think when you get down to talking about actual mechanisms, obviously there's significant overlap with the work of Task Force 1. So I think there's a lot of hammering out that needs to be done between the two task forces after the initial reports.
One more follow-up, and then I'll – did you guys at all talk about, okay, regardless of whether someone opts in or out, is there certain data that must be displayed to the public no matter what? I guess we would call that – in our task force, we kind of call that stuff non-sensitive data. I don't know if you have a term for that, but is there anything that – did you guys talk about this needs to be required to be displayed, and it doesn't matter – whether the registrant opts in or opts out, this stuff's okay?
Yeah, I think we have had various proposals, but I think there's – I've not heard any objections, I guess, is the way else. We haven't had a vote on this, so that's how I'll characterize it. I haven't heard any objections yet to the idea that technical – sort of all of the information associated with technical contact and other technical information about the domain, like it, you know, name servers and whatnot – along with the name and country of the registrant and admin contact should be in that sort of public access tier, I guess I would say. And then other data, where we get less certain is if there is a protected, you know, if there is sort of a way to, you know, get a digital certificate or sign up for a username and password that gives you access to more data, whether that should be all of the existing data that's gathered or some subset thereof, I think we're a little less certain. But I think we have a pretty good agreement without having taken a vote. So I don't want to convey that the task force actually agreed to this. But I think I haven't heard any objections to the idea that those are the fields that would go into the public tier.
Okay, thanks. Any questions from any other task force members of any of the task forces for Jordan?
This is Kathy. I just wanted to add something regarding the notifications, since I asked Task Force 1 about that. It might be interesting for everyone to know a little bit about the Task Force 2 discussion, not decision, but discussion. When we're talking about revealing data that is sensitive, it was raised, and not just in the non-commercial constituency ALAC comments, but by another constituency as well, that, you know, the data that's being revealed could have very real implications for human rights organizations and for people whose personal privacy may mean kind of life and death issues. Thinking about stalkers, ex-spouses, it's an issue very real in the United States where more than 1 million women are stalked every year. And we do have stalking incidents now coming out of the WHOIS. And so one of the things that we've been debating, again, not deciding, is the timing that it might to provide registrants with real-time notification that their data has been released, unless perhaps they opt out, would it kind of empower people to help police any abuses of the sensitive data? Someone who comes in stating one purpose and actually uses it for a different purpose, uses this data. So I just wanted to mention that as well.
Okay, when you say unless they opt out, can you explain that?
Well, it was raised in our constituency, in our task force as well, that, you know, some people may be getting lots and lots of notifications about the use of, you know, about people coming in to get their sensitive data. But rather than kind of immediately assuming that people don't want to see the requests, one thing that a number of constituencies agreed with, but not everybody by any means, is that first give people the option to have it in real time. Again, so if somebody's address is given out and it's a human rights organization and they have to flee, or if it's a woman and she knows her ex-spouse is the one who got it, she has to flee. You know, you don't want to have to go to a database and look that up. You may not know that someone has accessed this very sensitive, very personal, very important information. So the first option might be to give real-time data and then allow people that other option of perhaps saying, okay, I don't want to know in real time. I don't want to get 10 email messages a day. I'll go to the website and check it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks.
Right. And let me just add another principle that I think there's fairly widespread agreement on is that registrants should be able to opt to display more of their information to the public than might be required. So if a company might in order to get a digital certificate or to do business with people and convince them that they're fine, upstanding citizens, might want to publish their information and have it available to everyone, and they should have the option to do that.
Okay.
Jordan, can I add one thing? This is Steve Metallis.
Yeah, go ahead.
As Jordan indicated, we haven't reached final decisions on some of these matters yet. One issue that's been put on the table by at least two constituencies is whether the best way to handle the kind of situation that Kathy was talking about is through a case-by-case process of allowing people under special circumstances to have less data displayed, such as is done in some CCTLD. So that's still up for discussion.
Any other questions or comments for Jordan? Task Force 2? Okay, hearing none. Brian, you still on the line? Brian, if you're on, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. Task Force 3 is charged with improving the accuracy of WHOIS data. And one of the things we initially did was survey the registrars as well as companies in other industries to assess their data verification practices and with respect to the companies in other industries, see whether or not there was information we could glean from their practices for making recommendations for best practices regarding WHOIS data in this context. The registrar survey, I think, resulted in a few responses, maybe three or four, that were helpful. But the survey of companies in other industries resulted in very limited responses, primarily because those companies were concerned about the proprietary nature of their data verification practices. And we did not want to disclose that, notwithstanding that we represented that the information would be held confidential. So as a result, there was very limited information for going forward and developing best practices. Nevertheless, the task force was tasked with creating a best practices document for improving data verification and to determine what verification mechanisms can be used cost effectively to combat deliberate provision of false information and what other mechanisms could be employed. So what we've done is, without the benefit of the data, gone ahead and drafted some somewhat general recommendations regarding best practices that we thought we might be able to recommend and implement, and we're still, we're not very far along in reaching an agreement regarding those practices. But some of the things that we're currently discussing would include having ICANN work directly with the registrars to develop best practices for investigating and remedying reported inaccuracies in registrant contact data. Implementing a graduate scale of sanctions for breach of the registrar accreditation agreement. So rather than having the single sanction that's currently in the agreement, with the idea that if you have a graduated scale, you're more likely to have enforcement that would improve WHOIS data accuracy. We're also discussing continued development of the best practices beyond this particular PDP, including investigating options for automatic and manual data verification processes that might be implemented for improving that data accuracy. Currently, another issue that we've considered is whether or not to include the last verified date and the method of verification as WHOIS data elements. which was recommended by the Security and Stability Advisory Committee. We understand that that's been discussed a little bit, Task Force 2, and that there at least a few of the members of that task force have expressed the opinion that that issue belongs in Task Force 3. In Task Force 3, one or two members of the task force have expressed the opinion that that belongs with Task Force 2. So that issue is being kicked around a little bit. I think my personal view is that we could handle that in Task Force 3, and it would make sense to include the last verified date method of verification as to its data elements, but we're still debating that internally within the task force, and how that ultimately shakes out remains to be seen. But part of the best practices we're considering would be to have the registrars take a more direct role in developing best practices and plans to improve the accuracy of WHOIS data. One of the, and then another issue, let me just throw this out quickly before I conclude, is looking at procedures for facilitating updates to or correction of WHOIS data by domain name registrants. That's something that is under discussion. It's unclear to me at this point how, whether or not we're going to reach agreement on that issue, but that's kind of that's an issue that we think might be worth including. So we've also recently reached there's an issue or discussion within the task force that is fairly critical, which is whether or not we should make specific recommendations that would deal with implementation of policy regarding WHOIS data accuracy, or whether or not any recommendations about implementation would be outside the scope of the task force. There's some disagreement on that issue within the task force, and we've raised it. I sent an email to Bruce Tonkin today to try to get his views and clarification. If as one view that has been expressed is that any policy implementing, suggesting implementation of recommendations regarding WHOIS data accuracy would be outside the scope of the task force. If that's the case, my sense is we're going to have a very limited and general preliminary report. Even more so than the somewhat modest recommendations that I just reviewed with you. So once that threshold issue is resolved, which hopefully will be soon, we'll kind of see where we go. The goal at this point is to go ahead and we have two or three members of the task force working on a revised best practices document or section of the report, and that hopefully will be circulated to the task force tomorrow or Friday. And then I think we're going to just try to vote on that next week, and then so that we can have our preliminary report available for distribution by the deadline of the 28th. That's where we are. But there's, at this point, it's unclear to me how far along we're going to get with substantive recommendations. But that's where things stand at this point.
I'm sorry, it's Marilyn. I didn't understand the threshold question. Could you just restate it? Just re-say it again?
Ross, you want to articulate that? Ross, you still on the call?
I don't think I could be any clearer than what you already have, Brent.
No. Ross,
okay, I'll give it my best shot. Ross, feel free to jump in if you feel the need. There's a discussion that within the task force, I guess raised by Ross as the rep of the registrar constituency, that if we make any recommendations regarding improving WHOIS data accuracy, that our recommendations suggesting implementation of practices to achieve, to improve data accuracy, that implementation is outside the scope of the task force, and that we're limited to making general policy recommendations. My sense is, as I read the terms of reference for the task force, that we're essentially being asked to make some recommendations about implementation of practices that can improve WHOIS data accuracy. I have a fundamentally different view on that issue. But if that issue, as was raised, is correct, then we're we're going to be coming out with something that's going to be very limited in terms of just sort of general statements as to, you know, things that might be considered.
So we'll
see how that shakes out. I mean, when I look at the terms of reference, and when I look at Bruce's email from yesterday, or maybe it was this morning, about how he sees the forces moving forward, both in the preliminary report thereafter, seems to me that he's looking for some fairly concrete recommendations about how to implement some of these changes. But, you know, I could be wrong about that.
I'm just going to speak as a counselor who's been through this before for just a minute. I think, and it's great to ask Bruce as the chair for his interpretations, but hopefully we will have in the body of the PDP and in other practices broader guidance for the task forces. In the past, we have assigned the practical work of assessing how a policy would be implemented to an implementation working group that had different composition and expertise. And so, I don't know, I just wanted to ask Ross a question. We didn't create a new task force because an implementation group cannot change policy that is recommended by a task force, but it has in the past been given the responsibility of assessing the feasibility, in some cases determining the practicality, cost, other kinds of things. Is that what you were suggesting, Ross, or were you actually thinking that this would be a different policy development process?
The former, not the latter, if I understood your statement correctly, or your question correctly. In other words, that at some point after the board has approved the policy recommendations of the council, that a working group made up of, similar entities that we've used in the past would evaluate those recommendations and make further recommendations regarding implementation.
Yeah. Didn't we, now I'm going to have to actually, is Glenn on the call?
Yes, sir,
and canceled.
We'd have to go back and look at where in the process that we did the implementation working group. Because in one case, I think it would be worthwhile doing that, and that's something that maybe Glenn could do for the three chairs, is just quickly look back and see where in the process.
Thomas here. Could I get into the queue, please? I think I was part of several of these groups, so maybe I could hop out here.
You are Thomas.
Yeah,
good.
Thomas, and then anybody, I was also part of a couple of the implementation committees, so Thomas, go on.
We had implementation committees inside the GNSO, which basically dealt with reviewing policy recommendations and asking, can these policies be implemented and how do they have to be changed so they actually make sense in practice. That's the kind of implementation group that happened before things went to a council vote. The other kind of implementation group is like the transfer assistance group on which Jeff also served, for instance. That group dealt with a policy recommendation as approved by the board and essentially cast that kind of policy into practical contract language and into things that are directly implemented by registrars and registries. That's the two kinds of groups that have been there.
This is Steve Metallic. Could I get the cue, please?
Sure. I'm sorry. Who was that?
Steve Metallic.
Okay, Steve. Yeah, I think Thomas said it all from the past we've done it, so I'll just I'll give the floor to Steve, and then anybody else after Steve?
Yeah, I'd like to speak close to her.
Paul, okay. Okay, Steve, and then Paul.
If I understood Ross correctly, his concern would not really go to what's recommended by the task force. It would just go to what happens afterwards, which, as I understand it, is the model that's been used. If the recommendations are approved or at some point in the process, an implementation group is formed, but it doesn't sound to me, unless I'm misunderstanding this, that Ross is raising any concern about what would be in the recommendations of the task force.
Hey, Ross, this is Jeff. Do you want to respond?
Yeah, I think so. Sure, we could look at it like that, Steve, but I think it's important that the task force does their work once and not have it revisited by other parties down the road if we can avoid it. So I'm talking about very, very simple things that we can fix or change within these recommendations to avoid that down the road. Having gone through it once with transfers, it's just a lot of work that can be avoided if the task force does its work correctly the first time.
Okay.
This is Brian. Can I get in the queue here?
Sure, Brian, then Paul still in the
queue.
Sure.
It seems to me that to the extent the task force is going to advance the ball, it needs to make some specific recommendations about who is improving who's data accuracy. And my sense is, and Ross, correct me if I'm wrong, that many of the specific recommendations you would rather not have them included in the report and include a very general statement that is largely as a policy statement for the GNSO Council to act on would be largely meaningless. And I think that if we can get some agreement that some of the specific recommendations are appropriate, and then just vote as a task force on the merits of each such recommendation, then at least we can give the GNSO Council something that's specific enough for them to consider and that will actually advance the ball a bit.
Yeah, I'd have to correct that sense, Brian. It's again, it's completely not our position. We should probably pick this up within the task force.
Do we have a queue? Because I have another question.
Let me get to go to Paul first, and then
sure.
Marilyn, and I want to cut this a little bit. I want us to get to some other things, and maybe we'll circle back if we have some time. So Paul, then Marilyn.
My observation of Task Force One, we tried not to talk too much about implementation, but on the other hand, it's a difficult problem because we don't want to come up with a policy that's impossible to implement. But I think that we concentrated way more on the policy side than the implementation side, which I think is the right approach. And if Task Force 3 decides that they could come up with implementation recommendations, then all the task force should be able to do that same thing.
Okay. Marilyn, and anybody else after Marilyn? Okay, Marilyn?
I'm going to make two comments. One of them being council previously determined that, look, task forces make policy recommendations. They also put other information into their report that can be taken into account. But we have not left the process of determining how to implement a policy has in the past been undertaken by a group that is specific to examining that, and they are not able to devise new policy. If a new policy were found to be needed, that would have to go back to the task force to do. We've really kind of operated in a bit of a separation. I wouldn't see any reason why a task force could not include in the body of its report its work, if it in fact has done substantive work about implementation. But as those of you who've lived through implementation groups know, that is a different kind of substantive work than we've done on policy development. And I do think it'd be good for us to just clarify some of those things, not just with Bruce, but with the ICANN legal counsel. And if we need to take it up in the next council meeting as a question, then we need to figure out the chairs would need to work together with Bruce to formulate the question to council.
So I think drawing on what Marilyn has said, I think it's incumbent upon Brian, myself, and Jordan with our task forces to try to frame the question and get it to the council. As Marilyn said, not just Bruce, but the entire council, pose it to them. But by all means, you know, don't lose the stuff that you've already done. If you've done some work and you have some thoughts on it, you know, either in a footnote, an appendix, or whatever, obviously you don't want to lose the work that you've done, but we'll pose the question to council and get their feedback, and if council wants to get advice from the board or from ICANN staff, then they can do that. Is there any other questions on Task Force 3's work other than this this notion of implementation? Or anybody from Task Force 3 that wants to add anything about the work? If I could throw out a question, Brian, is
sure.
There, I mean, you mentioned one area about the verified date as being one element of possible overlap with Task Force 2. Do you see any other areas of your report that would overlap either with Task Force 2 or Task Force 1? And the reason I ask is because I want to get into a discussion in a few minutes on coordination.
Well, you know, there's been a little bit of discussion on the, particularly from ALAC, some issues concerned about privacy. I think that will be expressed, but I think at the task force, we'll see how the vote comes out, but we've largely taken the position that that's really a separate issue that Task Force 1 is going to deal with, and I think it's really beyond the scope of our task force. But that issue is obviously remained to each of the task forces and one that addressed. But I don't know. We're not specifically going into the privacy issue. You know, we've had some pretty extreme positions articulated by the ALAC on the privacy issue, essentially that there shouldn't, you know, well, in any event, they will be stated in the report because we're going to include all the constituency statements in the report. But we're not as a task force dealing with that issue per se. I don't think we have any specific recommendations tailored toward privacy. And I think the last verified date is the one issue that seems to, you know, there's some discussion as to where it properly belongs and whether or not we should in Task Force 3. Ultimately, you know, we'll just take a vote on that, whether that should be one of the policy recommendations.
Okay. And Jordan, do you going back to Task Force 2, you talked about some of the overlap with Task Force 1. Do you see any other areas of overlap with Task Force 3? And again, with an eye towards coordination after the preliminary reports.
I don't directly. The only thing I possibly see is a question's been raised as to what mechanism might be used to identify, you know, if a tiered access system or something like that were implemented, how you would identify requesters. And I guess theoretically some of the same mechanisms used to identify registrants might be applicable. That's the only conceivable place, and there's certainly been no recommendation by the task force that those necessarily be the same mechanisms.
Okay, and I think Task Force 1 probably the same, that most of the overlap we see is between Task Force 1 and 2 and only some limited areas with Task Force 3. Brian, do you get that sense as well?
Yes.
Okay, so next week we're all going to be submitting preliminary reports by next, I think it's next Friday. And so the question is, under the procedures of the PDP, there will be a 20-day public comment period on the reports and followed by a certain period of time in which we need to get a final report done. A few of us were talking and thought it might be beneficial to try to get some sort of extension on the final report so that we could possibly have some time in Kuala Lumpur for those people that are there to do a working one or more working sessions. You know, certainly a session for people to comment publicly with open mic, but also a session where a group of us can, you know, get together and drill down and do some writing and exchange ideas just within the task force. Obviously, we would need the council's permission to do that. My question I want to throw out there is their general support in us trying to get, in us making that kind of motion to the council to try to get, it may amount to, you know, a 60-day extension of time to file the final report. It may only be 45. I don't know the exact number of days, but something like that. Is that something people would support?
Jeff, it's Marilyn. I guess my comment about this would be, if it is a highly structured, I'll make two comments. If it is a highly structured comment approach at the open mic and people restrict their comments to commenting on what's in the report and trying to be helpful and fact-based, I think that might be useful. But I think if we're going to find ourselves in an emotional, pardon me for characterizing this way, but I rant from any of us, including myself, I'll try to take my drugs before I come. You know, we need to figure out how to, if we decide to do it, we need to figure out how to do it in a way that's productive. Secondly, the calendar is incredibly crunched already, and so we should just take that into account as when we do our planning.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. The more important, I mean, not that it's not important, obviously we want public input, and they have the chance after the reports are filed. I think the real point that I wanted is for working sessions within the task force is to try to coordinate the reports and make sure that, you know, that they're concrete reports, or even, you know, at that stage, Task Force 1 and Task Force 2's reports could be joined by that point, so to work on that.
Could I comment on this?
Yeah, sure. If someone, before Steve, if you go, someone's phone's not on mute, and we're getting an echo. Okay, Steve?
Yeah.
You are now muted.
Changing the schedule, I guess, I think a lot of people have been proceeding on the assumption, I think, that there would be final action on these reports in Kuala Lumpur. I think that's the original timetable, right? And this would, your proposal would postpone action on them until sometime after Kuala Lumpur. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it definitely would.
Okay.
And really, because the other thing I want to talk about, especially, and Task Force 3 can decide for itself, but certainly having more coordination between Task Force 1 and 2 after the preliminary reports with joint phone calls and maybe even after, we can talk about during the joint phone calls, but we can kind of, you know, maybe even combining the two task forces, making that recommendation. But
well, I agree there needs to be more coordination, and I'd like to get back to the point of coordination. But just in terms of KL, if this is not going to be decided in KL, I don't think we should assume that we will get any more participation by task force members there than we have on this call. You know, it's a multi-thousand-dollar commitment for people to go to, at least from the United States, to KL, and I don't think that we will. I mean, also knowing how things usually work in an ICANN meeting, I think we could have a more productive. I'm not sure that having a face-to-face session in KL is a realistic goal if there's not going to be action on the reports there.
So would it be, Steve, your recommendation that, you know, we just have some of these joint calls after the preliminary reports and see how much progress we can make, and then at a later time, of course, then, you know, Marilyn's point of scheduling.
No, I mean, I agree with that point, that we should try to decide this question soon, and I don't know when the council is next meeting. It's not scheduled to meet for another 3 or 4 weeks from now, is it?
When is council meeting?
Yeah.
We have a meeting the 10th.
Okay, so that's 3 weeks from now, and I think the sooner we can decide whether, you know, we'll keep to the KL timetable or not, the better. I'm just pointing out that it may not be realistic to think that we will have a big turnout in KL that would facilitate this type of coordination. I also would like to get back to the coordination point, but I'll yield now for responses on your proposal.
Okay. Any other? Then I'll get back to you, Steve. Any other thoughts on KL or an extension?
Well, this is Tom Keller. I just want to say that I guess it would be very helpful to have a face-to-face meeting in a closed session and just talk things through. That's usually more productive than having phone calls.
Yep, this is Paul Stavera. I agree with Tom.
Couldn't hear Tom, sorry.
He thought it would be productive to have a face-to-face meeting. I agree with that.
Anybody else?
Thomas Wessler here. I think besides thinking about a face-to-face meeting, we should also consider the idea if we can extend the 20-day public comment period. We are throwing three reports at the general public in parallel, and 20 days may be relatively short time for people to digest three reports and comment on them. So it could be productive to extend that timeline to, say, 30 or 40 days, if that's possible with a meeting in KL in the end, so people have more time to comment, and maybe some of us have more time to reach out and solicit comments.
Thomas, my question is really for you and Steve and Antonio Harris. Do you estimate that three combined reports will be bulkier than the report of the last task force?
They will address more topics than the previous task force report. The previous task force report boiled down to four consensus policies plus a lot of material. The current report will have a variety of policy proposals, best practices proposed, and a lot of analysis. So it's material that's more difficult to digest. There is more to comment on than with the previous task force, I believe.
I think...
Also, the proposals are much more complex than the policy proposals the old task force had. If you remember, the old proposals were essentially the WHOIS data remote policy, no bag access for marketing purposes, and two others that I've already forgotten. So that's a lot simpler than the proposals and possible proposals that are being tabled, that are being put on the table now.
That's helpful. I just want to note, Thomas, my objection to being referred to as old. Can we please be the initial task force? That's just a joke. But I take your point.
I guess I'm just getting older.
Okay, any other comments? So I think we'll take that feedback back. I think, Thomas, I think your point of a longer comment period is excellent. I think you're right. There are, you know, as far as length, I could tell you, you know, our report with all the constituency statements and everything added to it, it's going to be pretty bulky in and of itself. To combine that with two others in one report, you know, to comment on it is a lot. So I think that's a good request, and I think one that we should definitely make. I'm going to put that aside for now, and I want to ask and get back to Steve on just the coordination. Certainly, I want to propose that Task Force 1 and 2, at the very least, have some joint calls after the preliminary report, and we could talk about Task Force 3 as well. But, Steve, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, my comment was this. We have two types of coordination problems here. One and two have addressed a lot of the same issues, and without getting into you know, who's within scope and who's out of scope, there's overlap there. What the situation that Brian mentioned regarding the recommendation on the last verified date and method data elements is a problem of whether something falls between the chairs. That's different. I mean, it's the opposite of overlap. It's a potential gap. And I hope we can get that resolved as quickly as possible, because I wouldn't want to see these reports go forward without either task force addressing that question. So what would be the method in the next, you know, couple of days for determining which task force is going to address that question?
Well, I think the question with regard to the overlap...
I'm not asking about overlap.
You're talking about the implementation.
Yeah,
I think that one... I think Task Force 3, Brian, I think you sent a note to Bruce. I think Bruce needs to circulate that among the council. And I think... I guess you guys need to wait for feedback from the council on that. I mean, I'm not sure how that... You know, we have a preliminary report date of next week, so I'm not sure how the council will handle that.
Steve, Jeff, may I ask a question to Steve?
Oh, sure.
That's Ross here, Steve. Were you referring to the specific issue of the last verified data elements being included in the WHOIS?
Yeah.
And whether or not that should be dealt with by Task Force 2 or Task Force 3?
Right.
Yeah, so that's a slightly different question than the implementation issues that we talked about earlier.
Yes, I agree. It's not the same. It's a question of where, which basket that falls in.
Okay, I'm sorry. I misunderstood as being the other. Okay. I think Brian and Jordan should have a conversation and talk about it amongst their task forces as to where they, you know, obviously falls in somewhere and shouldn't be left out. And so I think, Jordan, do you have kind of any view on that? Have you guys even talked about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was raised by the IPC in their constituency statement. We haven't had, I think, really substantive conversation about it. And without, I think, some interaction with, I mean, some insight from Task Force 3, it's not, I think, 100% clear to me, at least, what exactly it would represent. Because, with you know, we don't have verification requirements, you know, other than, you know, notifying registrants of their obligation to, you know, keep their data current. There's not an ongoing sort of maintenance procedure right now, so not 100% sure what the date would even represent. I think that based on the work of Task Force 3, it may become, you know, a lot more interesting, and so I would speculate it seems to perhaps belong a little bit more over there. And I don't think, I mean, I guess the only extent to which it may apply to our work would be, you know, if we viewed that as being sort of public versus sensitive versus, you know, super sensitive data, and we could perhaps take a position on that.
So this is Steve again. So is the upshot that Brian and Jordan will decide which task force is going to handle this?
I think I would make that recommendation at this point.
All right.
And even if it's handled in one report, in the preliminary report, in the end it may go to the final report of another task force.
Yeah, I understand that, but at least to get it out.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously our goal is to get all the ideas out there, and if it's not supposed to be with one task force, we'll fix that problem after the preliminary report. Just like I think the overlap with 1 and 2 won't be fixed until after the preliminary reports come out either. And so we'll have to recognize that there's overlap. So what I would propose then is that we kind of set... I'm sorry, is there anyone else that wants to comment?
Sorry, Jeff, before we move on, and this is Kathy, I just wanted to make something about scheduling, and I don't know if that's going to affect what you're about to say.
No,
I just wanted to add my 2 cents on that, if I might.
Sure, no, please.
Which is that I agree with Steve, that Kuala Lumpur is an extremely costly venture. And I can say, at least from the non-commercial constituency perspective, we've had, you know, good attendance, and we've had people in Tunisia and Rome. I don't know how many people we're going to have in Kuala Lumpur, but I would hate to have a major meeting there. I mean, everybody, all these task forces, we've all been working very intensively since November. Let's get our materials out there. Let's let people comment on them. And let's use Kuala Lumpur to move forward.
Okay. I think we kind of have some divergent views on that. But I think, you know, first comes first is that we should probably arrange for a schedule of at least
Task Force 1, Task Force 2 combined phone calls, conference calls after the preliminary report, starting as soon as, you know, the following week after. Because we don't, like we said, we can make the request to extend the public comment period and to extend the time which our final report is, but we should operate currently as if it's not going to change. So I would make a recommendation that we go back to our task forces, find good times to have these joint meetings. And Task Force 2 and 1 will also to talk about whether it should replace the existing weekly meetings or be in addition to. And so what I would recommend is that at least those two task forces go back and talk about some good times that they can have these combined calls. I think that's going to be essential. And then during these calls, we can talk about whether Task Force 1 and 2's reports should be combined. Task Force 3, I think, is pretty distinct, except for those couple issues that we mentioned on this call. Brian, do you see any other need to have coordination phone calls with the other task forces? Brian, you might be on mute there. Okay, turning it over to anyone else on Task Force 3. Does anyone else on Task Force 3 see a dire need to have joint calls with the other task forces?
Presuming that Brian and Jordan can come to some sort of a landing on Task Force 2 picking up the issue of loss verified, I don't see a need for that.
Okay.
Pause, by the way, sorry.
That's okay. Marilyn, yeah?
Well, at some point we need to have joint discussions, even if we don't have them before we open the 20-day comment period. Maybe we ought to use the 20-day comment period to further, you know, work out any, we'll be getting comments from others. It might be that we could do some joint calls during that time.
Yeah, I think, Marilyn, what I was envisioning, and I was assuming, and I know it might be a little optimistic, but I was assuming that the public comment period was going to start within a couple days after we turned over the reports to the council. I was assuming it would be posted, and then they would start the comment period. So, yeah, these phone calls would all be during the comment period.
Okay.
I think, and probably afterwards as well. But I also think, to add what I thought you were going to say, was that we probably should have at least one status call with all three task forces to kind of combine and tell everybody where we're at, kind of like this one.
Yeah.
So why don't we just kind of throw that about our task forces and at least Task Force 1 and 2, if we can decide a good time, a good day of the week to have kind of set up scheduled calls to coordinate those two task forces. And then we'll also try to set up at least one time during the public comment period where all three task forces can come together to talk about the status of where they're at. How does that sound? Does anybody object to proceeding in that manner? Okay, hearing no objection, is there anything else anybody wants to bring up during this call?
Excuse me, Jeff, this is Suzanne. Could I put a question out?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you. I need to try to clarify for the GAC just exactly what they need to anticipate. And I want to clarify what I think I've understood. What will be circulated as for public comment will be three separate discrete reports.
Correct.
Am I correct? Okay.
Yes.
So at any point in time, and perhaps the GAC had simply misunderstood this, I believe the GAC has operated under an assumption that at some point, the three task force reports would be merged into a single policy proposal. Is that anticipated?
Well, Suzanne, it's Marilyn. You could expect that council would submit a single set of policy, a consolidated set of policy recommendations to the board. But I'm not sure that's the question you're asking us.
That's part of it. So thanks for the clarification, because just a point of clarification on my end as to how the GAC operates and the constraints I am operating under. I am both serving as liaison and convener of the GAC Working Group on GNSO. We have scheduled a meeting for July 17. The GAC likes to start its meetings on Saturdays and Sundays. Don't ask me why. with the anticipation that we would be looking at a combined single set or single policy proposal, if you will, such that I just wanted to alert you to the fact that you are not likely, with all apologies, because we're not structured to operate this way, you are not likely to get comments from the GAC per se in your public comment period. We are only able to develop GAC positions in a GAC plenary.
Could your, do you have a working group on GAC?
We do have a working group, and I would intend to, as soon as I know that the three discrete reports have been posted, I would tell everybody on the working group, as well as, frankly, the entire GAC on an FYI basis, but the working group in particular, that the reports have been posted and that we need to review them. But what is awkward for the GAC to contemplate is, and what I can do with your guidance, would draw people's attention to the specific policy recommendations in each discrete report, because we would imagine that they would in some way, shape, or form be forwarded then in the council final decision, whatever council finally agrees on.
Well, GAC's role to this is probably worth maybe you and Bruce and the general counsel kind of thinking about the process and the timing, because I think GAC's role to counsel, there are liaisons to counsel. I am trying to think about, I believe what GAC has done in the past, Suzanne, has been to assume that they are providing advice really to the board as opposed to counsel, and that they are liaisoning with counsel.
Yeah, Marilyn, if I can add just a little bit to that, just to clarify for Suzanne, just to go through the whole process. There will be the public comment period now is only one of a couple of public comment periods.
Okay.
The way things have worked in the past is that the task forces themselves has this public comment period before they submit the final report to the council. Then the council then will then forward its recommendations to the board, during which time, at least in the past, what's always been done is that there is another public comment period on the council's recommendations.
Okay.
So there'll be several different time periods, and I would, you know, if the time periods aren't extended at all by the council, then what would happen is that July 17th would probably work in during or right about the time as the public comment period that ICANN board would have on the GNSO's proposal. That may be even before the time period, but there certainly would. I don't foresee any action taken by the board before July time frame.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. Could I ask just two other specific questions? And let me know if I'm keeping you all too long. I apologize. I can send it by email. It's just to the task force chairs.
No, please.
One had to do with, I have been asked by one U.S. federal agency, well, actually independent regulatory body, as to whether Task Force 1 might still find it useful for to have input in response to the questionnaire as to the uses of the data. The specific agency is the Federal Trade Commission.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've gotten a number, well, from the FTC, we've gotten a lot of information from previous workshops. But what I would say is, at this point, we're going to come out with our preliminary report, which certainly welcome their comments along with everybody else's during that comment period that's going to start, you know, in about 2 weeks or a week and a half after it's posted. Certainly would love comments from them at that point in time if we haven't addressed their point of view. I think we have enough, a lot of stuff from them. I'm not sure. I don't want to say no, because obviously we want all input. So if they don't think the preliminary report covers what they want, then I certainly would expect them to comment.
Okay, that's very helpful. I will share that with them. What they've actually done is apparently drafted responses to the specific questions that you had put out.
Yes.
So it's not a question of a set of comments per se.
And sometimes agencies, Jeff, have trouble. They can respond to a questionnaire. They might have difficulty providing the comment in a public comment period. I don't know that for sure. But wouldn't it just, if they have the responses, wouldn't it be good to just go ahead and take them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If they're done with them, then please, you know, we do have some time before the preliminary report. If they do have them, then please, forward them on. We'll
thank you. I had another question, and I don't know if this is even appropriate, but to the chair of Task Force 2, first with apologies, because we, the United States government, have been unable to develop a coordinated response to those questions. Many GAC members I know did not feel that they would be able to develop responses. I'm wondering if you would be willing to share with me whether you have had any government responses to the questionnaires.
Yes, we've had a few responses, maybe just one, actually. If I go back to the archive, we've not had very many. One or two, I think.
Have we had government responses, or have we had responses from specialized groups such as the Data Privacy Commissioners?
That is a distinction I'm not smart enough to make, Marilyn.
Perhaps we could ask Barbara Glenn to look, because you know, some groups are, Suzanne very carefully noted, an independent agency as opposed to an administration, and those distinctions exist in some other governments as well. And it just would be helpful for us to give you a fact-based answer, Suzanne, and I don't know the answer.
Suzanne, looking at the at the archive of responses to the survey, this is Steve Metallics, looking at the archive of responses to the survey, I don't think any of them have come from government.
I don't recall a response of government.
This is Barbara. I don't recall seeing anything from the government or government agencies either.
Okay, maybe I've overstated then. So yes, we have not had any formal government responses, it looks like.
Okay, thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Okay, anybody else have any comments, questions before we end this call? Hearing none, I want to thank everybody for coming on this call. I think it was extremely productive, and it's good that we can hear what's going on in the other task forces, and I look forward to our next next joint call, and also to seeing everyone's reports next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Suzanne, we'll catch up.
Yeah, let's do that. Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.